Welcome to the Hannah Miller Show. And here she is, Hannah Miller.
Outspokenly conservative and unashamedly Christian, this is Hannah Miller, and this is what happened while we were away. The American Federation of Teachers lobbied the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention on, and even suggested language for, the federal agency's school reopening guidance released in February. Jill and Joe Biden took a new and now infamous photo with former President Carter and his wife, Rosalyn. A CIA marketing video fully embraces intersectionality. Oklahoma and Florida essentially called it a wrap on their COVID response. Oklahoma Governor Kevin Stitt virtually said they've reached enough benchmarks so they can open, while Florida Governor Ron DeSantis essentially said none of this was in line with liberty and we want no part of it. Furthermore, DeSantis signed a bill making permanent his executive order banning vaccine passports by government and businesses alike and suspended all remaining pandemic emergency orders down to the local level. Juror in Derek Chauvin case Brandon Mitchell took part in a Black Lives Matter protest last year. This is following the confession a few weeks ago of an alternate juror who said she was afraid of riots if she served on the jury and returned a not guilty verdict. On May 5th, Johns Hopkins School of Medicine and Bloomberg School of Public Health professor Dr. Marty Makary revealed he's not afraid to call out the nation's government health experts and media when he feels that they are being overly cautious when it comes to the handling of COVID-19. From the lifting of restrictions for the vaccinated to the forced isolation of Americans to the health bureaucracy's lack of common sense. Also, if you Google stories on how many people voted in the 2020 election, you'll find the number is around 159 million people. Well, according to the just-completed U.S. Census, around 154 million people voted in the 2020 election. That's a difference of around 4 to 5 million votes. Previous year's censuses have had the total voting number pegged at around what was reported after the election, 159 million. This means either the Census Bureau is trash or voter fraud is real. Take your pick on the truth. In my personal opinion, either of those options is viable. Just as a side note, though, the popular vote difference between Biden and Trump was roughly 4 to 5 million votes. The findings of a peer-reviewed study just published in the American Journal of Therapeutics concludes that the readily available, inexpensive, off-patent drug ivermectin is effective in treating existing cases of COVID-19 and in preventing coming down with the disease. Unlike the experimental vaccines that we are being ceaselessly urged to take, ivermectin has been around for many years and is safe for all but a few people. And lastly, a feel-good story for the week. A 20-month-old girl who fell out of a car and into a bay Sunday after a multi-vehicle crash on a bridge in Ocean City, Maryland, is expected to make a full recovery thanks to a humble hero who jumped into the water to save the child, authorities said Monday. Ryan Whittington, firefighter and medic at Ocean City Fire Department, told CNN on Monday, the man who saved the toddler is choosing to remain unnamed publicly. Fire department is calling him the humble hero for his rescue. The man was driving on the bridge and his car was also involved in the crash, Whittington said. The drivers were pointing down to the bay where he saw the girl lying in the water face down. He just jumped into action, said Whittington, adding that the water in that area is about 5 feet deep and the jump was more than 25 feet deep. He saved a 23-month-old child. There was no doubt in our mind that if he had not done what he did when he did it, that we would be having a different headline to this story. The girl and the man were rescued by boaters in the bay, Whittington told CNN. All right, so that's what happened. Let's talk about a few of these stories. The first one I want to go back to is the powerful teachers unions, full court press. So that preceded the federal agency putting the brakes on a full reopening of in-person classrooms, emails between top CDC, AFT, and White House officials show. The emails were obtained through a Freedom of Information Act request by the conservative watchdog group Americans for Public Trust and provided to the New York Post. The documents show a flurry of activity between CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky, her top advisors and union officials, with Biden brass being looped in at the White House in the days before the highly anticipated February 12th announcement on school reopening guidelines. And apparently that lobbying paid off because in at least two instances, language suggestions, and I put quotes around that, offered by the union were adopted nearly verbatim into the final text of the CDC document. And that's the document which put 99% of students in, quote, red zones, not viable for a return to in-person learning, despite the fact that roughly 60% of students had already returned to in-person learning, some for months, in those same red zones. And this is actually one of the things that I believe kind of started the crumbling of the COVID-19 narrative that was coming from the government and the CDC, because so many parents looked around and just said, wait a minute, you guys are telling me that I can't send my child to in-person learning after they've been in in-person learning for months and there really hasn't been serious consequences. Our kids are doing fine. The teachers are doing fine. And I think that was kind of a wake-up moment for a lot of people here in the United States. And it comes out that a lot of this decision-making that the CDC was making, this guidelines that they came out, was greatly influenced by the teachers' unions. And of course, that doesn't really come as a major surprise to some people, but it is a reality that we need to be aware of what's going on in that relationship between the CDC and who they're allowing to influence them on these decisions that should not be politicized when you're talking about public health and especially our children. But they're allowing the lobbying of the teachers' unions to influence their suggestions. The second story, I'll just mention this because this one cracked me up this week. This is the Jill and Joe Biden picture with the Carters. This was hysterical because I first saw it and I just thought that it was somebody on the internet trolling somebody, you know, the Bidens, because their whole, you know, the whole argument that people were making was, here's Joe Biden, who has literally just said this week that, you know, even if you have a vaccine and I have a vaccine and we're outside, we should still be wearing masks. And now you're inside with two people who are very vulnerable. They're in the vulnerable age category. They're in their 90s. And you're literally right next to them, breathing on them. And yes, you all have your vaccines, but according to your own words, you should still be wearing your masks, even if you're outside. And now you're inside and you're not wearing a mask and you're taking pictures and you're breathing on one another. And so it was just very hypocritical. But I originally just thought it was some troll on the internet that was that had photoshopped this photo until I saw that it had been released by the Carter social media pages. They're all of their Facebook and all of that had kind of shared the picture as well. And I was like, oh, I guess this thing is for real. And that's when I realized that they had somebody on their staff had used a fisheye lens and just had no idea that that it would warp the photo like that. And of course, you use a fisheye lens when you're in a tight space and you're trying to get everything in the frame that you want to get a picture of. And so it just must have been too tight of a space for a regular lens and they had to put the fisheye lens on. So that just was kind of a funny thing that happened this week that I just chuckled over quite a bit. The third story that I want to talk about, this CIA video. This is unsurprising news that, I mean, it's become increasingly obvious, at least to me, that a lot of these organizations are increasingly embracing, I'll say that. I'll give them a little bit of wiggle room. But they're increasingly embracing just this popular narrative regarding race and intersectionality, especially. This latest CIA video, just for a little bit more information, it features a Latina officer who identifies as a, quote, cisgender millennial, end quote. And the video is a part of a new series called Humans of CIA. And of course, it's designed to attract a more, quote, diverse pool of candidates. And directly from the script, this is what she says as this video plays. I am a woman of color. I am a mom. I am a cisgender millennial who has been diagnosed with generalized anxiety disorder. I am intersectional, but my existence is not a box-checking exercise, end quote. Well, first of all, WebMD defines anxiety disorders as this. They're a group of mental illnesses that cause constant and overwhelming anxiety and fear. The excessive anxiety can make you avoid work, school, family get-togethers, and other social situations that might trigger or worsen your symptoms, end quote. And so there's a host of issues, really, in this whole video. But in that phrase right there, when she talks about having anxiety disorder, Cal Thomas pointed out in a recent article, he said, forget the other stuff. Why would the CIA be fine with an agent suffering from such a malady? And I think that kind of really puts his finger on, you know, we have just gotten to where we just full on embrace a lot of the anxiety disorders and mental health disorders that people have First of all, when I was growing up, when I was coming through high school, I had a lot of friends who labeled themselves with depression, anxiety, and these kinds of things. Of course, a doctor a lot of times had never diagnosed them as this, but a lot of times they strive for it because it was kind of a thing back when I was in high school and younger. I mean, it just was, it got you some attention and, you know, you got a little bit of a, I guess now looking back on it, it got you an intersectionality point and it got you a kind of a little bit of a victim status and some pity and sympathy. And so that was a kind of a popular thing to do. And now, of course, that generation of young people has grown up. And I'm not saying that, you know, she may have a legit anxiety disorder, generalized anxiety disorder, and have issues with some of these things or struggle with some of these things. But the reality is that as we're, you know, are we okay with just embracing it? Because that's what our culture wants us to do, is just embrace these things. Don't help them. Don't help them overcome it. Just embrace it. That's who you are. And it's totally fine if you have anxiety so bad you are not able to come into work, you can't go to school, and you're shutting yourself away from other people. You do you. And no. Obviously, but see, that's the thing that our culture is having to wrestle with right now, where on the one hand, we want to say, you know, you go to therapy, but at the same time, we're telling people, you know, get yourself some help and get all the help that you need, because it's all about you and what you want and what you need. At the exact same time, we're telling those people that they're fine just the way that they are. And so why should we go to any kind of counseling or therapy or medical professional to overcome these things when you're just fine the way you are? Because that's what this whole video, I mean, that's what this video just said. I've got all of these mental health disorders and it's totally fine. I'm totally fine. I can just keep going on and going to work. And then as Cal Thomas points out, wait a minute. Do we really want the CIA? Would any business really want somebody who's struggling with some of these disorders? Why can't we just look somebody in the face and say, look, I know this is a part of who you are, but it's not all right and you need to get some help. And we're not willing to do that anymore because it's denying somebody their true self. It's shutting them down. It's not embracing them for who they are. But all of that comes from, it stems from this belief that this kind of a utopian idea. Look, we're fallen human beings. Our bodies are fallen. Our minds are fallen. Sin is, you know, we have the natural man that we're trying to overcome, our sin natures. We don't want to be exactly who we are in our flesh because there are bad things that are involved in it. And so when we're trying to help people who have some of these disorders, and this encompasses things like transgender, I mean, that's described as a mental health disorder. But yet we totally deny that. You know, when we're talking about people having anxiety or transgenderism, bisexuality, all of these, you know, the gender dysphoria, those are mental health disorders and people desperately need help. Not for just to for us to just ignore it and say, well, it's who you are, it's a part of you, it's your intersectionality, and ignore. That is not helpful. It is not helpful for this woman. And of course, when we're talking about the CIA, you're talking about organizations that are responsible for the safety of the United States citizens. I have to ask, is this the quote, big stick that Teddy Roosevelt spoke about? I don't think so. And the other countries and our enemies, and I know people don't like to think about the Chinese and Russia as being our enemies, but in a lot of Middle Eastern countries as well, North Korea, they hate us. And they're laughing at stuff like this. When we're just like, hey, we have a bunch of individuals who are on the front lines, who desperately need help, but we're not recognizing it, and we're just sending them out there. That does not portray strength to other countries around the world that we desperately need to be communicating that to. Next story. Okay, so the juror in the Derek Chauvin case. So more information on that. The during the jury selection, the Brandon Mitchell, who's a 31-year-old high school basketball coach, was known as juror number 52. And before he spoke publicly last week, he had told Judge Peter Cahill that he'd only heard, quote, basic information, end quote, about the high-profile case and was certainly not aware of any information that would hinder his ability to serve as an impartial juror. However, Mitchell was pictured last August wearing a t-shirt that included references to George Floyd's death and Black Lives Matter. So the picture shows Mitchell, he's wearing this shirt. It's got Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s picture surrounded by the words, quote, get your knee off our necks, end quote, and BLM. He is also seen wearing a Black Lives Matter baseball cap. And then just for further information, because it's going to be relevant later, media accounts of the event shows it had several components, including advocating for racial justice, increasing voter registration, pushing for a new version of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and urging participation in the 2020 census. The event also focused on police use of force. Floyd's brother and sister and family members of those who had been shot by police addressed the crowd. It served as a rallying point for the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act, a federal police reform bill. So what does that mean for the Chauvin trial? Well, despite Mitchell kind of dismissing the Washington event as a, quote, a national thing, end quote, there are some legal experts who agree that the pictures is problematic. And one of those was jury consultant Alan Turkheimer. He told the Washington Post that Chauvin's attorney will no doubt use Mitchell to argue for an appeal. But the real question will be whether Mitchell provided false answers during jury selection, Turkheimer said. And then also, this was noted by the Star Tribune, Mitchell answered no to questions on the juror questionnaire that inquired whether he participated in demonstrations against police brutality in Minneapolis or whether he or anyone close to him participated in protests about police use of force or police brutality. And of course, those specific questions were answered in the description of the events when that I talked about earlier. Which really, as I said, it was this event that he attended, and we have pictures of him attending, were a rallying point for the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act, which was a federal police reform bill. And a lot of the conversation that happened at that event was about racial justice and was about what happened with George Floyd. And so it's very evident that, yeah, he did participate in some demonstrations that he said that he did not participate in on the juror questionnaire. So Turkheimer kind of responded to that and said that that could change the outcome of things. If there's anything that makes him seem that he was not forthcoming, it could be an avenue for the judge to reconsider the case. And then another attorney, a civil rights attorney, Brian Dunn, he agreed that the real concern is whether Mitchell lied about or failed to provide complete answers on whether he is engaged in public activism or whether he has any affiliations with Black Lives Matter that go beyond the mere wearing of the shirt. And he went on further to say, if it is determined that the juror did not provide full disclosure to the defense, the question then becomes whether this lack of candor violated Mr. Chauvin's right to a fair trial. And he added that the photo is undeniably suggestive of a possible bias in this juror. Quote, if Mitchell specifically was asked, have you ever participated in a Black Lives Matter demonstration? And he answered no to that, I think that would be an important appealable issue, said Joseph Daly, an emeritus professor at Mitchell Hamlin School of Law. So then, as expected, I think Chauvin and his attorney are seeking a new trial. His attorney said, quote, the court made several errors in handling the case, including abuse of discretion that deprived the defendant of a fair trial, prosecutorial and jury misconduct, errors of law at trial, and a verdict that is contrary to the law, end quote. So this thing isn't done. I suspected that it wasn't going to be done when they read the verdict out a few weeks ago, because it was within a day, there were issues that were coming out about the jurors, how some were selected, how they were not sequestered during the trial, and some of that that just became evident pretty quickly. And to me, there was other things, but I won't dive into all of those details, that just kind of gave me a lot of pause and made me suspect that this thing was going to be appealed, or they were going to seek, you know, they were going to seek a new trial. So that's where that's at. And I don't have a whole lot more to say other than just those facts, that it's imperative, whatever you believe about Derek Chauvin and about this case and what happened on the street with George Floyd, you have to agree that the United States justice system, it is imperative for us to have impartial jurors. And it seems to be coming out that that was not the case in the Derek Chauvin trial. And I completely agree that if this becomes evident, that he deserves another trial. And I'm glad to see that his attorney is seeking to do that. Next story I want to talk about. So this was about Dr. Marty Makary, Johns Hopkins School of Medicine and Bloomberg School of Public Health professor. So just 2 months ago, Makary kind of took the Center for Disease, the CDC and Prevention, to task for its absurdly restrictive, end quote, guidelines for vaccinated people. And the doctor said that though the CDC claims to be following the science, the truth is the agency is still paralyzed by fear. Now Dr. Makary has his sights set on the fear-mongering coming from the media and so-called experts who claim the U.S. won't get to herd immunity in these days, even though we're seeing the COVID-19 pandemic waning. So what exactly is he saying? Makary aired his latest grievances with the alleged science followers in the pages of the New York Post this past Wednesday with a new op-ed headlined, "Don't Buy the Fear-Mongering, the COVID-19 Threat is Waning." And this is what he said. Americans are being fed a distorted perception of the risks by the media and some experts. They continue to fuel fear by repeating speculation that variants will evade vaccines. Don't buy it, he began. He then pointed out that about 57% of American adults are vaccinated, and around half of the unvaccinated population currently have natural COVID-19 immunity from prior infection, which explains why cases in the U.S. have been plummeting. They've been dropping 31% over the last 2.5 weeks, and really they've been going down since January. Then he provided some context. He said this. He said, to put things in context, during the mildest flu season in the last 8 years, there were 24 million cases, according to the Centers for Disease Control, and approximately 447,000 daily cases during its peak week. By comparison, we're averaging 49,641 daily COVID cases. That same mild flu season resulted in 280,000 hospitalizations. By comparison, current COVID hospitalizations as of May 1st are 34,905. And of course, he went on to warn that no one should confuse COVID-19 with the flu and that there is a definite risk among susceptible people. But for anyone who's immune and lives where the caseload is low, the threat of COVID-19, according to him and his words, is now defanged. So again, he said, during the mildest flu season in the last 8 years, 24 million cases, 447,000 daily cases during its peak. And currently, we're averaging not even 50,000 daily COVID cases. And continuing to compare, that same mild, very mild, according to the CDC, mild flu season resulted in 280,000 hospitalizations, while we're currently, as of May 1st, have not even 35,000 COVID hospitalizations across the country. So if that's a mild flu season, what is this? Are we overwhelming our hospitals? You know, remember that's what it was all about? That we were going to overwhelm our hospitals and that our medical infrastructure was going to totally collapse. Well, obviously, that's not happening now. And it really didn't happen the entire last year. We had one or two hot spots that got into some trouble where they needed some help that came in from the outside. But for the most part, your average hospital was able to bear up under COVID-19. And as a matter of fact, a lot of them had to lay a lot of people off because of canceling other procedures and then not having the workload from COVID that they thought they were going to end up having. So in conclusion, he said, it's time to end harmful social isolation and abandon the goal of absolute risk elimination at all costs. And of course, that was my contention from the very beginning. You know, this goal of absolute risk elimination at all costs, it became very evident pretty quickly that that was the goal. It moved from, you know, 2 weeks to slow the spread and blah, blah, blah. You know, it progressed from there and the goalposts kind of moved and moved and moved until finally it was just, everybody's going to stay locked down completely until there's not a single case left. And that's just not feasible because people's jobs are at risk. Their mental health is at risk. Children's education is at risk. And so he's saying, look, this thing really has been defanged and we have to abandon this goal that we have of just no, you know, of absolute risk elimination. And of course, you and I know that there is no such thing as absolute risk elimination. Life is risky. Life, you know, anytime that we're in our homes or in our neighborhoods, things can happen. And of course, we don't want to take undue risks and we want to be careful and be faithful to take care of the bodies that God has given us. But at the same time, we don't need to be fully embracing a lot of this fear-mongering that's continuing to go on. So the last story that I want to get to, and then we'll wrap things up, this was the peer-reviewed study from the American, that was published by the American Journal of Therapeutics. This was, you know, well, I'll give the conclusion of the study first. So the conclusion of the study reads that meta-analysis based on 18 randomized controlled treatment trials of ivermectin in COVID-19 have found large statistically significant reductions in mortality, time to clinical recovery, and time to viral clearance. Furthermore, results from numerous controlled prophylaxis trials report significantly reduced risks of contracting COVID-19 with the regular use of ivermectin. Finally, the many examples of ivermectin distribution campaigns leading to rapid population-wide decreases in morbidity and mortality indicate that an oral agent effective in all phases of COVID-19 has been identified. Just a reminder, we've known about the possible benefits of ivermectin since early last summer. This is a drug with almost no side effects that's been around for decades, I think roughly 60 years. I think it was the 1960s, and who the inventors received the Nobel Prize for Medicine and Physiology. That drug was treated as a life-threatening, obscure drug at worst and completely ignored as a possible treatment at best. You know, I am someone who has used this drug multiple times a year, depending on the dosage, on my livestock since I was 8. So I'm very familiar with this drug. So when somebody first said ivermectin, I was like, what? That's, you know, it's an antiparasitic. That's what we give it to our livestock for. So I'm quite familiar with it and its relatively harmless nature. There's only a select few people in the population who have underlying conditions that would make them vulnerable to ivermectin. A very, very, very small percentage of folks. And so there, for all the rest of us, this is a very harmless thing for us to come in contact with. And I know that because growing up, you know, it's not very easy to get a tube of ivermectin paste down the throat of a 1,200-pound animal that doesn't want it. So now they have all these fancy, you know, you put it in, they have it that tastes like applesauce and all these wonderful things now. But back in the day, they didn't. And, you know, you just had to kind of force it down and horses didn't like it. Cows didn't like it. So it could sometimes become quite the struggle, especially if it was a young horse and we would get ivermectin everywhere and, you know, all over our face and our eyes and our mouths and yeah, no harm. And so when somebody first mentioned ivermectin to me, I immediately knew, oh yeah, that's a harmless thing for us to try. But it was vilified immediately and it disgusted me. Absolutely disgusted me. And so this has been, you know, now all the people that are saying, well, we have to have all these peer-reviewed studies and we have to look at all that. Well, to me, it just seemed like, well, what's the harm? There was no harm in trying this drug that we've had for decades, but yet these are the same folks who say we have to have all the peer-reviewed studies, we have to have, you know, all these numbers of people that have taken it, that we've looked at, that we can say, okay, now it's safe. These same people are totally okay with an experimental drug that only is approved by emergency to be plugged into your body. And I'm not against getting it, especially if you're in a category that has some of the comorbidities. You do you, but allow me the choice of doing what I want to do, and don't restrict information and don't vilify things that don't deserve it. So that's an update on there. And then just as a conclusion for today, I was recently reminded of the story of Jonah by a pastor friend of mine. And so for those who are unfamiliar with the story, the purpose of this book was to show that God is a merciful and gracious God. Although the wicked city of Nineveh deserved to be crushed immediately, God was patient towards them. And Jonah was, in my opinion, a reluctant prophet and an angry prophet. He displayed his reluctance because, as we all know, he originally ran from God before delivering a message of repentance to the nation of Israel. I mean, to the nation of Nineveh, excuse me. Then when God extended mercy and spared the Ninevites, Jonah became angry at God when God extended that mercy instead of justice, what Jonah believed to have been appropriate. So in chapter 1, God directed Jonah to go to Nineveh, but Jonah disobeyed, boarded a ship, and headed for Tarshish. There was a big storm. Everybody became concerned. Jonah explained that God was bringing judgment upon him, and the sailors threw him into the sea, where he was swallowed by an enormous fish. And in chapter 1, verse 17, it says, "And the Lord appointed a great fish to swallow Jonah, and Jonah was in the stomach of the fish 3 days and 3 nights." So then in chapters 2 and 3 of the book of Jonah, after God had the fish cough him up onto the beach or onto the sand there, 3 days later, Jonah obeyed God and went to Nineveh to fulfill his mission. Jonah preached a message of repentance, and to his surprise and chagrin, really, the sinful city repented. And chapters 3, verse 5 says, "Then the people of Nineveh believed in God, and they called a fast and put on sackcloth from the greatest to the least of them." And then in chapter 4, God deals with Jonah's anger and teaches Jonah about his love and compassion. So many of the stories about this week, from this week in the news that we've kind of highlighted and that I'm sure y'all have consumed, they highlight a culture dwelling in utter confusion. And often I think of the verse in Isaiah chapter 5, verse 20 that says, "They say that what is right is wrong and what is wrong is right, that black is white and white is black, bitter is sweet and sweet is bitter." But the final verse of Jonah is what my pastor friend reminded me of this week. And I want us to dwell on that for a moment, because what was happening in Nineveh was the fleshing out of these verses in Isaiah. And it is what we see going on now. We are living in a culture, as described in Isaiah 5:20, that says what is right is what is right is wrong, and what is wrong is right, and, you know, we're confusing those things, etc. And the consequences are what God described in the last verse of Jonah. Quote, "There are more than 120,000 persons who do not know their right hand from their left," end quote. Confusion. The Ninevites were living in utter confusion. So are we. What did God send to correct their confusion? It wasn't a better politician or stronger man-made laws or the military. God sent the message of sin and a savior. When you and I look at our culture of confusion and think it's a lost cause, or we become bitter and give up, believing our culture deserves the judgment of God, we should remember a few things from the life of Jonah, or this portion of Jonah's life. First, we should recognize the sin and confusion our culture lives in, but do not grow bitter and angry towards people that do not know their left hand from their right. They are lost, confused, and spiritually blind. We should not expect anything different from a spiritually blind people, but should extend grace and mercy to them, just as the Lord extended mercy to the Ninevites. The second thing is, do not grow weary in doing good, of being faithful to share the message of Jesus. My dad frequently says, and as a matter of fact, we recorded his podcast right before we did mine, and he said these words. He said, our only strategy is evangelism, and our only weapon is the truth. Let's not forget that, and let's not grow weary in the sharing of that. And I think that's what was going on with Jonah. That's why he ran. He was bitter. He was angry. He didn't want anything to do with those Ninevites, and he was weary. And I know that I deal with that, especially, you know, when I'm going through all of these stories, and I feel like we're just being lied to left and right, or people just seem so blind. And so I remind myself of what the scriptures call us to. And third, finally, let's be diligent to pray for God's mercy and compassion on us as he had for the Ninevites, and that a great revival would sweep across the land. And I'll close with one of my favorite quotes right now from Dr. Scott Atlas. Those of us who want the truth must seek it, and those of us who find the truth must speak it. Of course, his reference, I don't think, was to anything but just straight facts, but you and I as believers know that we must continue to seek the truth, the one who is the way, the truth, and the life. And when we find him, we must speak of him.
Thank you for listening to The Hannah Miller Show. Please remember to subscribe to this podcast. This podcast is produced by Bob Sloan Audio Productions. If you'd like to find out more about Hannah or to schedule her for a speaking event, go to her website, thehannahmillershow.com.